KWBU is happy to bring you this airing of the recent on-topic conversation between Baylor University President Ken Starr and Senator George Mitchell. This program was recorded on April 16, 2013 in Waco Hall. You can find this interview on our website as well at kwbu.org. We begin tonight's program with Ken Starr's introduction of Senator Mitchell.
What a warm Baylor and Waco welcome. We should begin by remembering Boston and the suffering and the tragedy of Boston. President Obama just this morning referred to what had happened as a heinous and cowardly act. And so tonight, as we talk about peace, conflict resolution, we remember Martin Richard, the late year old boy, and his family, and the other victims of the Boylston Street savagery. So we are, as the provost said, deeply honored to welcome back at this sorrowful time, and yet we march on to Waco and our campus, one of the truly most distinguished public servants in American history. And our special guest was last here on campus at the Baylor Law School. Dean Tobin is here at the invitation of Dean Tobin, but indirectly from a great Wacoan, Bernard Rappaport, who we lost just a few months ago. So, Senator, at Baylor, we love to tell what we call the extraordinary stories of our students. And the provost's introduction says it, doesn't it, that what we have here is a powerful American story. Father, born to Irish immigrants, and then his dad was adopted by a Lebanese family in Maine. The senator's mother was herself an immigrant from the Middle East, from Lebanon. And neither of the senator's parents were privileged to attend college. His father worked as a janitor at Colby College, and his mom worked a night shift in a local textile mill. So as you would imagine, the student, George Mitchell, while playing basketball and doing all those other things, worked to help make ends meet. Listen to the jobs that he held as a student. A dorm proctor, but he was also a construction worker. He was a truck driver. He was the night watchman, and amazingly for someone who was elected overwhelmingly several times, an insurance adjuster. I guess in Maine they have short memories. And so it should come as small wonder that during his time of service as a federal judge before he entered the United States Senate, the future senator and world-renowned diplomat and envoy enjoyed, above all his important judicial duties, administering the oath of citizenship to new Americans. And in connection with one of those naturalization ceremonies, a brand new citizen remarked, "I came here because in America, everybody has a chance." And so as we begin our conversation this evening, and we'll range around the world and come back to the United States, we pause and we remember Boston. Senator, your reflections.
Well, first, I want to thank you, Ken, for inviting me here, for your very kind comments, and Elizabeth, who's no longer up there, for that really generous introduction. As you might expect, I speak publicly often, and since I'm not particularly interested in what I say, for me the highlight is the introduction. There's a risk to it, though. The risk is you hear this stuff often enough, you start to believe it. So I always like to begin with a story that brings me and everyone else down to earth. As you indicated in your introduction, I was in Northern Ireland for about 5 years. when I returned, I wrote a book about my experience, and I set out on the obligatory book promotion tour. I got many invitations, and I learned, interestingly enough, that in the United States, there are more Irish American organizations than there are Irish Americans. And all of them invited me. I could only accept several, but I did, and I set out around the country. And there developed in these Irish American societies a competition as to who could give me the longest, most fantastic, often ridiculous introductions. And I reacted very badly. Instead of viewing them with the skepticism they deserved, I encouraged them. One guy went on for about a half hour, and I said, but you forgot to mention that I received the Science Award the year I graduated from high school. By the time I got to the last stop, the Stamford, Connecticut Irish American Club, my head was swollen. I was feeling self-important. And the first person I encountered when I entered the building was an elderly woman who rushed up to me, very excited, nervous, grabbed my hand, shook it vigorously, almost knocked me over. She said, I'm so thrilled to meet you. I think you're such a great man. You've done so many things around the world. She said, I don't live anywhere near here. I drove 3.5 hours just to shake your hand, to say that to you, and to ask you, please, would you sign my poster? And I said, sure. So she handed me what essentially was a political poster with a big photograph on it and a pen. And I said, I looked at it and I said to her, I'm happy to sign your poster, but before I do, I think there's something I should tell you. She said, what's that? I said, I'm not Henry Kissinger. It was a poster of Kissinger. She was shocked. She said, you're not. She said, well, who are you anyway? And when I told her, she was terribly disappointed. She said, that's awful. She said, I drove 3.5 hours to meet Henry Kissinger, and all I've got is a nobody like you. I said, well, I'm sorry you feel so bad. I wish there's something I could do to ease your pain. She thought for a moment. She said, well, there is. I said, what is it? And then she leaned forward, literally our faces were touching, and said in a conspiratorial whisper, nobody will ever know the difference. She said, would you mind signing Henry Kissinger's name to my poster? So I did. And somewhere today in eastern Connecticut, there's a poster of Kissinger hanging with his name written by me. Now, here's the best part. A few months ago, I did a program similar to this with Kissinger. We had a moderator, and he and I in New York, and we asked questions about everything in the world. And I thought it'd be a good occasion to tell this story, which I did. And the crowd loved it, and Henry liked it. So after the program was over, we were in the elevator going down to the ground floor. And he said to me, I've been with you several times. I've heard you speak often, particularly when you were Senator Majority Leader. I have never heard you better than you were tonight. I said, really? I said, what was most impressive? My answer about China, about the Middle East? He said, no, it was the introduction. He said, that's a great story. You should tell that all over America. So I can now check off Waco, Texas on my national tour of telling the Henry Kissinger story. But it was a good reminder of the importance of humility. My reflections first on Boston. I feel personally about this because I grew up in Maine. I've spent a great deal of time in Boston. I am involved in one of my current occupations as I'm listed as a director of the Boston Red Sox. I'm a consultant, and I go there quite often. I was there just a week ago and literally walked the street where this event, this tragic event occurred. And so, as you, and I'm sure everyone here, my heart goes out to not just the parents of that 8-year-old boy, but all of those who were so grievously injured as a result of this terrible act. It's a challenge to our society, to our principles. We all know that in every society there is a continuing tension between individual liberty and collective security. And no more, nowhere is that challenge greater than in this, the most open society in all of human history. And we wrestle with it all the time. Among the principles that our country is founded on and which contributed to the greatness of American history and society is, of course, the primacy of individual liberty. An independent judiciary, the rule of law, an opportunity for all. That's what has made us great, and we all believe in that. At the same time, we all recognize that given changes in the world, given advances in technology, from which we ordinarily benefit. Every one of us tonight, I hope, turned off their cell phone, and we all enjoy enormous benefits in our daily lives as a result of technology, but we don't think often about the fact that in no area of human activity has technology advanced more rapidly than in the ability of humans to kill other human beings in larger numbers with fewer resources, fewer people. And it's very difficult to maintain openness in a large, diverse, democratic society such as ours, at the same time protecting against such events. I believe we'll meet the test as we have many other tests in the past, but it will trigger a national debate. What do we do with open public events that by their very nature are impossible to fully protect, to make certain that no person can come along? It's a 26-mile route. It's open to everyone. It's a joyous event. It's a big event in Boston because Patriots Day is a holiday only in Massachusetts. They combine a Boston Red Sox game that starts in the morning at 11 o'clock, the only Major League Baseball game played in the season that starts before noon, with the marathon. But I think we're up to it. I think we will meet the challenge. It will be difficult. We, of course, cannot speculate. We don't know who, how, or most importantly, why this event occurred. But we do know that such events occur with increasing frequency, not just in our, but in other societies. And it poses a very difficult challenge for us. On occasion in the past, there have been excesses one way or the other. But I think the greatness of American democracy is the capacity for self-correction. When we find that we've made mistakes, as we have often, no human being, no human society is free of error. We take steps to acknowledge and correct it. And I think we'll get through this, but it's impossible to measure the loss. I'm a parent, and I know many of you here are parents, and the first thing you think of when you hear about a child being killed is, how would I feel if it were my child? So it's really impossible to know what those parents are going through. But we have to stick together as a society and a nation, and we'll see our way through this.
Would you join me in thanking the senator for that important reminder of this balance that's so vital between liberty and an ordered society on the other hand, and we so treasure our freedoms, including the ability under the First Amendment, freedom of association, to come and organize, say, Irish American groups. That's very good that there's so many Irish American
groups. There are.
Let's travel around the world, and let's first, we'll focus on foreign policy. And as appropriate, as the provost mentioned, the senator was asked twice to serve on a very special assignment relating to the Middle East. Most recently, President Obama asked him to serve, as he did for 2 years, as special envoy to the Middle East. And then a decade before, again, as the provost mentioned, your work, the Mitchell Report on the Middle East, which was well received. So if you would, talk about that part of the world, and especially the prospects for peace as you see them, and especially the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Right. I said earlier, and it was quoted this evening, that I believe there's no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. And I do believe that, including as to the Middle East. While it is not possible to be immediately optimistic in the short term, it's a very complex situation, very difficult. made more complex by a series of intersecting conflicts that occur in the region and that all of which impact on one another. You have the ongoing tremendous struggle within Islam between Sunni and Shia that is erupting now in Syria, in Iraq, in Pakistan and other parts of the region. You have the ancient hostility between Persians, Iran, and the Arab countries, in particular the Gulf Arab countries, which is now at a high pitch. You have the rise in Islamic fundamentalism. Throughout the 1400 years of Islam's history, there have been periodic tendencies toward fundamentalism and then contractions and then expansions back and forth over time. You have the tremendous impact of the economics of oil in our own society and around the world, and the confluence of interests that we have in the Western Hemisphere with Asia in terms of access to oil from that part of the world. So a number of intersecting conflicts. Although it's difficult now to foresee the circumstances under which Israelis and Palestinians will reach an accord to live side by side in peace, two states for two people, I think it will happen in the medium term for a variety of reasons, most important of which is that I believe it to be very much in the self-interest of the two societies. I think ultimately societies like individuals act largely out of self-interest. And while it poses a risk to both to enter into an agreement, an enormous risk for Israel, the risk is in fact much greater than if they don't enter into an agreement. As with many issues of international policy, you don't get a choice often between a really good alternative and a really bad alternative. The choices often are between two not very good alternatives, and you have to choose which one is best. And I think that for Israel, the absence of an agreement with the Palestinians creates a much greater risk than if they entered into an agreement, not just with respect to themselves and the Palestinians, but also in enabling Israel to establish more normal relations with all of the other countries in the region, many of whom, the Gulf Arabs, share an antipathy toward Iran, but are unable to exercise it because it's overwhelmed by this Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, what are those risks? This will take just a moment because it is a complicated subject. There are many. For Israel, demography. There are at this moment about 5.75 million Jews living in the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. There are in that same area just over 5.25 million Arabs. The birth rates are such that it will happen very soon, as possibly as early as 2015 or 16, and certainly not later than 2020, that the majority will be Arab. And if that occurs and a two-state solution has not been obtained, then Israel faces the awful choice, which they should not have to make, of being either a Jewish state or a democratic state. They cannot be both. This is widely discussed there, not much here. Ehud Barak, the former prime minister and defense minister, has spoken of it often there. That's a very difficult choice, and they really ought to be pressing to get an agreement now. The second threat is rockets. The history of man is a history of warfare, and is also a history of most societies, and particularly militaries, fighting the last war, preparing for the last war only to be surprised by the next one. Israel now has total military dominance in the region, in large part due to its own energy and also due to the tremendous amount of assistance that we provide in financial and military aid and in our security guarantee to them. But the threat in the 21st century is not going to be of Arab armies crossing the border, tanks and large numbers of men, or suicide bombers. The threat is from rockets. Hamas has 8,000 on the southern border, crude, ineffective, but still they create fear and anxiety. Hezbollah has 30,000 to 50,000 on the northern border, somewhat better than Hamas's, but still not fully threatening. Most threatening of all is Iran has made the technological leap from liquid fuel rockets to solid fuel rockets and now possesses an arsenal of rockets. I'm not talking about nuclear weapons now, conventional weapons, that can reach anywhere in Israel launched from Iran. Now, there's never been an event in human history where several thousand rockets have been launched from different sites at once, particularly against a very small area like Israel. And you have to go there to see how small it is to appreciate the threat to Israel's security. And so we don't know what would happen, and what we must do, of course, is to embark on a strategy that prevents that from ever occurring. But that's a real danger. And the third danger is isolation. Israel's support in the United States is very strong, particularly in the House of Representatives, but is declining everywhere else in the world. When I was a president's envoy in the region for about 2.5 years, I spent a substantial portion of my time in Europe and Asia trying to shore up our allies to achieve a united front. That's the threat to Israel. Palestinians face an even greater threat, and that is 60 more years of living in an occupation in which people are not free to move about. Commerce is difficult to engage in because of the many restrictions on travel and so forth and the costs imposed in that respect. And most importantly, they're denied the dignity and self-respect that comes from self-governance, a principle in which we strongly believe and which is really set forth in the most eloquent terms in our Declaration of Independence. But they have a problem. In 1947, the United Nations proposed a partition. Israel accepted it, the Arabs rejected it. They thought they could easily win the war. They were wrong. Israel won that war and every one that has occurred since then. There is not a sensible Arab leader today who would not gladly accept the 1947 offer were it still available. But it is not. It never again will be because the facts on the ground have changed so dramatically. And the Palestinians have rejected other offers made in between. I said to Arafat many times when I met with him and repeated to the current president, Abbas, when I met with him during my most recent assignment, there is not a shred of evidence, none, to suggest that the offers are going to get any better in the future. So although you might not like it, you got to sit down and negotiate and stay in negotiations and get a stake. It won't be 100% of what you want. You will regard it as not fair. But it's better than 60 more years of occupation. And once you get a state, you can build on it. And they've demonstrated the capability to do that. They're an able and energetic people. But they have to realize that the longer this goes on, the more difficult it becomes for them. And so at some point, you have to say, sit down, negotiate, get it done. I think there will be leadership on both sides that will eventually overcome the difficulties of divided societies. And they're both divided. There are many Palestinians who are adamantly opposed to Israel's existence. There are many Israelis, including several in the current government, who are adamantly opposed to the existence of a Palestinian state ever. But the majority in both societies sees the advantage of a two-state solution. And I think the time is coming when they'll do it. President George W. Bush, about 10 days before he left office, went to Jerusalem and made a very powerful speech in which he discussed what I've just been discussing and said that the key is each side to recognize that it is invested in the other's success. Because the only way that Israel can get security in the long term is by the creation of a Palestinian state. And the only way the Palestinians are ever going to get a state is if Israel has reasonable and sustainable security.
Let me move from the Palestinian Authority and Israel, the two-state issue, past Gaza, and let's go to Egypt. Egypt had an election. The Muslim Brotherhood, now in power, today issued a statement sharply condemning the Boston bombing. fact, the Brotherhood said that Islamic law does not condone violence against civilians. Well, a predictive judgment. Will the Muslim Brotherhood, if it remains in power, so let's assume that it remains in power, and your judgment prove to be a partner that the West can work with?
I think it's impossible to answer that question with any degree of certainty now. There are many examples in history of entities which began as revolutionary movements. Once they achieved power, managed it in a democratic way. There are many other examples where that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. History is filled with examples of very bad governments that were removed by violent revolutions and replaced by worse governments. The obvious, most recent example, of course, not most recent, but the most obvious one, is Russia, where the people were oppressed by the Tsars for centuries, but no one would argue that Stalin's murderous regime was an improvement for them. So you can't be assured. The Muslim Brotherhood is under great pressure now, internally and from external forces. First and foremost, their economy is declining rapidly. Revolutions always do cause an economic decline just simply because of the upheaval that occurs. But this revolution that ultimately put them in power was indigenous, it was by the people, and it was based upon the importance of getting economic, educational, other improvements in ordinary life. It wasn't based on ideology or other factors. They won, although in a minority, not a majority, they were a plurality, because they were better organized than the others. And the opposition continues to be disorganized. I hope that they will recognize that their interests lie in establishing and living by democratic institutions adapted to their society. They don't have to have an American Senate and House and Supreme Court identical to ours. There are many forms of democracy. Indeed, most democracies in the world are parliamentary in nature, unlike ours. The real key and the difficulty in the region of all of those countries that are primarily Islamic in establishing democratic rules is not in holding elections. It is in guaranteeing the rights of minorities. That's the hardest part of democracy to actually take hold. How do you reconcile the principle of majority rule in a democratic society with absolutes of certain rights that are not subject to majority rule, as in our Constitution? That is not an easy thing for any society. It hasn't been for ours. And it's going to be very difficult for them to do, and we have to be supportive and patient and understand that while we are the dominant economic and military power and we wield influence around the world, it is not our role or responsibility to dictate to others how they should govern themselves. It is our right to do what we can to encourage and support those who share our views. And throughout Islam today, there is a massive struggle going on, not just Sunni versus Shia, but between moderates or responsible people who think that the best method of governance for them are democratic institutions, open societies, where people can get ahead by on the basis of merit, as we're based, and those who believe in theocratic societies, such as the current system in Iran. And that struggle over the next half or more century will have a great effect on geopolitics in the world and on what we do. We can't decide it. We can influence it by our example and our support for those who share our values.
Let's move to Iraq. Sunni, Shia violence has erupted again.
Yeah.
Just last week, Prime Minister Maliki published a very intriguing op-ed in the Washington Post. And the Prime Minister wrote this, and I quote, "The overwhelming majority of Iraqis agree that we're better off today than under Hussein's brutal dictatorship." Almost as soon as he wrote that piece, Iraq erupted once again with numerous bombings just yesterday, six different provinces, but especially Baghdad, affected. 50 dead across the country, hundreds injured. What's your assessment of Mr. Maliki's rather cheery view with respect to Iraq?
Well, his statement is undoubtedly true, but it sets a very low bar. To say it's better than it was when Saddam was there isn't a very high bar to be over. The problem, of course, is that prior to 1919, there was no Iraq. It was a fiction created by the British and the French at the peace table in Versailles, when a British civil servant took out a map and drew lines on it to create two countries which had never before existed, Iraq and Jordan. And the British did so as a way of paying back an Arab leader who had supported them in the First World War. And that was the Hashemite family, and they took one son and put him on the throne of the newly created Iraq, and another son and put him on the throne of the newly created Jordan. Prior to that, for 400 years, Iraq was four different administrative provinces in the Ottoman Empire. And so the creation of a nation which didn't exist, mixing up religion, tribe, clan, has made nation building a very difficult thing there. I think they've made, in fact, significant advances. The most alarming thing about the events that you describe, Ken, there is a report in the press today that much of this involves the assassination of Sunni candidates. That's a very dangerous thing, because what it suggests is that it is the beginnings of a renewed wholly sectarian conflict that could lead to civil war between the two, and I think would endanger the fragile democratic institutions that they have in place now.
Speaking of civil conflict, Syria. In that same op-ed piece, Prime Minister Maliki went on to talk about Syria, and he argued that America's ongoing support of the rebels in Syria may actually lead to an al-Qaeda takeover in that country.
Yeah.
In your view, what's the best tack, what's the best policy for America with respect to the bloody conflict that has been underway for so long now in Syria?
Yeah. I think it's important to understand that in most of the countries in that region, this is a generalization, but it's largely true, that there are three contending forces. You have the established government, in many cases, as in Syria, a military dictatorship, which acquired power by force through a coup, Assad's father, and have maintained it through the use of force and terror since. Then in the opposition, and they often tend to be minorities, the sect to which the Assads belong, the Alawite, are only about 12% of the population of Syria. Then the opposition comprised largely two forces, again, a generalization, but largely true. And they are the equivalent of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamic parties, which tend to be better organized and better disciplined. And then the others, who are a conglomeration of Western-oriented democracy-believing, but they're fractious like we often are. They can't get together, so that they don't actually represent politically the numbers of the people that support them. And so we have this challenge of how do we handle it in each society. They're not all the same. They each has different cultural histories. In Syria, I do not favor direct American military intervention. We've just ended a 12-year war in the region. We're trying to end a 14-year war. And the last thing we need is another major war there. There are people who say, let's bomb Syria, let's bomb Iran. It's kind of easy to start these things, but it's awfully difficult to end them. I do think that we can and should be supportive through a variety of forms which the administration is engaged in. I think that should be stepped up, assisting the rebels. But it's a catch-22, because the rebels consist of al-Qaeda forces, one group we've denominated a terrorist group, fighting alongside and often are the most effective fighters against others in the region. And you have to think not only what our policy should be toward the current regime, we support its leaving power, but what will happen after they leave. It is possible, perhaps likely, some would say probable, that there will be a continuing conflict, a struggle for power between the two elements of the opposition forces that did not break into overt violence in Egypt, although there's been plenty of violence, but could do so and is likely to do so in Syria with massive spillover effects in Iraq, in Lebanon. Lebanon is now being subject to tremendous strains because the fighting in Syria is spilling over there, and there are factions in Lebanon which support one side or the other. Hezbollah supports the government because its paymaster is Iran, and they're doing Iran's bidding, while the other groups in Lebanon, the Christians and the Sunnis, tend to support the rebels. Has a profound effect throughout the region, however it turns out. And I think the policy that we're following is the correct one, except that in not engaging directly militarily, but I think we should step up our assistance to the rebels.
Let me move to Pakistan. The Taliban in Pakistan likewise issued a statement today about the Boston bombings. Importantly, they denied any role whatsoever, so we shall see. But it was intriguing that strong force in Pakistan decided they, for whatever reason, needed to issue a statement. But let me just ask you generally, Pakistan, the country, a friend or not a friend to the United States?
I don't think we should evaluate other countries on the basis of friendship. I think we should evaluate them on the basis of interests. Every American expects American policy to be based on America's national interest. Why should we think that others should be different? We should expect the people of every other country to base their policies on what they perceive to be their national interest. And what we should search for are opportunities to share common interests and therefore build alliances with them. Not think of them as friendly or not friendly. In fact, there are many countries with which we consider ourselves friendly, with whom we disagree from time to time on policies. And so in Pakistan, it's a big country, and there are many people who would be opposed to thinking of the United States as a friend. There are also many people who very much want to have a Western-oriented, democratic, institution-based society, and who think to do that, you need to have a relationship with the United States and with Western Europe. They're divided. Our country's divided in many ways. So we shouldn't be surprised or put off by the fact that on occasion, people make statements or adopt policies that we perceive as contrary to our interests. What we have to do is work to establish common interest, to identify that where it occurs, but also to feel free to speak out in terms of our national interests, which is really what dominates our feelings. Pakistan is especially important because, of course, it's a nuclear power. It has a very tense and difficult relationship with India, and it has been American policy now for many decades in administrations of both parties to try to tamp down the possibility of conflict, to try to establish good relations with both, which is very difficult to do because they all measure their identity by the opponent. But I think that's the policy we should pursue. When we can agree with them, we should do so. We should be encouraging, again, moderates. That's the sort of the ground zero of the Sunni-Shia split, and do the best we can to maintain good relations with both Pakistan and India.
In Pakistan, a Christian Pakistani in a heavily Muslim country was recently released from prison. He was in prison for 8 years. The charge, the crime, was blasphemy. And had his appeal been unsuccessful, he would have faced, under Pakistani law, the death penalty. We're thankful that at least the ultimate sanction was not imposed, but he languished in prison for 8 years. What, Senator, in your judgment, should America do? What can it do? And what should it do with respect to promoting basic human rights, including religious liberty, which, as you can imagine, is very close to the heart of what Baylor is all about?
A very difficult task, but We are Christians. Islam is 1,400 years old. Where was Christianity when it was 1,400 years old? I'll ask the students here to go back and check their history. Not that there is any direct equivalence, because of course the time frames are different, a lot is different, but one of the most powerful messages of the gospel of Jesus is humility in judging others. And so I think we should begin with humility on our own past. I just spent 5 years in Northern Ireland where Christians were killing each other for 25 years and engaging in the most brutal and horrific offenses against other Christians. This is going to be one of the great challenges for the United States and for our leaders in the next half century. Think about this. It took 1,800 years following the birth of Christ for the Earth's population to reach 1 billion. 1,800 years to reach 1 billion. The most recent billion, the seventh, was added in 13 years. Mm-hmm. Now, projections show a declining rate of increase, but still increasing, and the most recent projections are, and these are notoriously subject to change, is that by mid-century or just beyond, there'll be between 9.5 and 10 billion people on Earth. Right now, 1 out of 5 persons on Earth is Muslim, about 1.2 billion. By the year 2050, it'll be 1 out of 3. There'll be 3.5 billion Muslims on this earth. That's the equivalent of the total population of the whole world as recently as 1965. How that conflict plays out within Islam and its relations with the West will dominate American policy by definition over the next half century. And we are going to be asked over and over and over again to intervene. The question you asked about Syria. People ask it about Somalia and about the Congo and about other places around the world. And the greatest challenge we will face abroad is for presidents to have the wisdom and the judgment to make the right decision on when is it appropriate and in our national interest to respond to requests for intervention and when is it not. And how we handle that challenge, not wholly within our control. This is to be decided by the people themselves. But we can influence it by encouraging support for those moderates, for the many millions of people in all those societies who want the kinds of things that we have and who are inspired by American ideals. People the world over still are inspired by American ideals. One thing I urge every American audience is never to forget that while we are the dominant military and economic power in the world, this was a great nation long before it was a military or economic power. This was a great nation from the moment of creation because of the principles set forth in our Constitution and Declaration of Independence. And that is what appeals to people around the world. They still, despite the complaints. I used to joke when I traveled in the Palestinian territories, I'd say to them, look, to a Palestinian audience, Americans turn on the television, they see a bunch of guys burning the flag with gasoline cans and burning rubber tires. I said, but I always say that if a guy from the American embassy walked up to the edge of a crowd and said, hey guys, I got some visas here, anybody interested? They'd all drop the cans and they'd all grab the visas and come here. And that's true. There remains around the world a residual admiration for American ideals, American justice, and most of all, for the principle that you said in the introduction, that in America, everybody has a chance. And so I think we have to build on that, and we can build on that. And you can't respond to every guy who makes a negative statement and build it up as though it's representative of the whole society. You know, that's a political tactic that everybody uses. Some oddball someone makes a statement and you take it and say, well, that represents all of them. That isn't any more true over there than it is here. There's a titanic struggle going on, and it's going to have an effect on us. We can't completely control it, but we should influence it in the right direction to the extent that we can.
You mentioned just a moment ago Northern Ireland, and because of what the senator did, as the provost mentioned, the President of the United States, President Clinton, presented you with the Medal of Freedom. It is the highest civilian honor that can be bestowed in the United States. I should note, by the way, that he's also been knighted by Her Majesty's government, but we can't call you Sir George here in the United States. But the point is, we are in the presence of someone who is a miracle worker. So would you tell us about the miracle of Northern Ireland? People thought it could not happen, but it did, and you were justly acclaimed for bringing that peace about, the Good Friday Agreement or the Belfast Agreement. Tell us how that happened.
The credit really goes to the people of Northern Ireland and to their political leaders. When you're in the middle of an eye of a hurricane, you're sometimes not the best judge of cause and effect, and so I'm not sure that I have the definitive answers. I think that'll await the judgment of history. But in my view, the public were exhausted with conflict. It was horrific. It was random. It isn't just the numbers killed, which are relatively small in comparison to other conflicts. It's the numbers maimed. There were a tremendous amount of ferocious beatings and maimings that left people permanently and awfully crippled and for life. And I think that ordinary men and women, particularly women, who became more active in the political process, who wanted nothing more than a normal or ordinary life of the type that we take for granted, instead of this fear-dominated society in which a person could be killed at random just because they happen to be a Catholic or a Protestant. And then the political leaders, ordinary men and women, just like people sitting in this room, the equivalent of our state legislatures, had been in conflict all of their lives. Many of them had been themselves shot, wounded. Two of the delegates to the peace talks were assassinated during the talks. Many of them had been convicted of terrible crimes in what they thought were acts of patriotism, what we would regard as acts of brutality and murder, or attempted murder. But they rose to the occasion in a very difficult time and entered in the agreement, even though some of them knew that they were ending their careers by doing so. And even though they all knew that they were putting their lives at risk and the safety of their families, it was an inspiration to me, having spent 5 years with these men and women, to see them do that. I think it is they who deserve the credit, and especially those who suffered adverse consequences as a result of it. Sometimes life takes twists and turns and produces unfair results. And the two parties on each side who were principally responsible for negotiating an agreement were defeated at the next election. Mm-hmm. And those who were less in support or in opposition to the agreement took power. But they did the right thing at the right time for their country. And I think that in every society there are leaders like that, that will come along and at the right time do the right thing. And I still have that hope in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Let's come stateside in the few minutes that remain before we invite all of you into the conversation and the written questions that have been gathered. Cream rises to the top, and the senator became Senate Majority Leader in fairly short order. Rose to Senate leadership, and during, as the provost indicated during her fine introduction, during his time, a lot of work got done, important work. The Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, enormously important. Americans with Disabilities Act, a huge landmark civil rights law. Both were passed with overwhelming bipartisan support. Indeed, the ADA was passed almost unanimously by the Senate. NAFTA, important to this audience, important to this part of the country as well as our neighbor to the north, but important to the United States. America's entry into the World Trade Organization, all this during the senator's leadership of the world's greatest deliberative body. When he became Senate Majority Leader, on his first day, the senator met with now Minority Leader Bob Dole of Kansas, and you told him this: "I will never surprise you. I'll always tell you in advance what I'm going to do. I'll never try to embarrass you. I'll try very hard not to make it personal in any way. I will expect the same treatment in return. And I will also never try to say or do anything that's insulting or demeaning in any way to you. Would you all like to see a restoration of that kind of atmosphere in Washington, D.C.? I think there's just such a hunger for it in the country, and how can we restore that, Senator?
I thought it was tough back then. It's really hard now. Bob Dole was the first person I called after I was elected Senate Majority Leader. When I went to see him, the preface to what you said, I said all the preface to it was, I said, look, I said, you've been here 25 years. I've only been here a couple of years. You know a lot more than I do about it, but my perception is these jobs are extremely difficult, and I think they'll be impossible if we don't have some level of trust between us. He was delighted. And after I set out those basics, we shook hands, and I can say with some pride that not once ever in those 6 years or since has a harsh word ever passed between Bob Dole and I in public or in private. We were and we are good friends. We disagreed almost every day. We negotiated, we did the best we could representing our beliefs and those who we represented and our, but we understood that we had a higher loyalty, and the higher loyalty was what's best for the country. Now, people of goodwill can disagree on what's best for the country. This is a very large, diverse country with tremendous differences in economic interests, regional interests, a whole variety of others. And you have to have the ability, at least, to listen to the other side, to give some credibility. I said in an interview in Waco here on either the radio or the newspaper that you don't really get someone to abandon their principles by schmoozing with them, by talking and having dinner. But what you do is you establish a sense of respect and personal relationship that allows you to have a somewhat more open mind to that person's views, not to immediately discount them or not to always think that you have the exclusive answer to everything. That may not make allowance for human error and for human frailty. It's a tough situation now. I spoke recently at the invitation of the State Department to a group of American ambassadors, and a guy said to me in a question and answer period, he said, "Well, when you were over in the Middle East, you had the toughest job in the world." I said, no. I said, "I had the toughest job in the world when I was Senate Majority Leader." I said, "The Middle East was nothing compared to the Senate, and it is very hard." But I do think it's important to establish personal relationships primarily for the purpose of fostering some degree of respect and trust for the other person and then for the other person's point of view. It makes it easier to enter into, engage in the kind of meaningful discussion and negotiation you have to do and to get better answers for the country.
As the provost is coming forward to continue the conversation and bringing the audience into it, I was going to sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game and invite you to have a seventh inning stretch, but my colleague said, please don't sing. I hate it when they do that. But it seemed to me appropriate to quote from Drayton McLean, Jr., who owned the Astros at the time of the Mitchell Report. So a brief comment about baseball. The words of Drayton McLean. Now that the Mitchell Report has been released, the Houston Astros are currently reviewing its contents. The Astros support the process that has taken place to compile this report, as well as the recommendations offered by Senator George Mitchell. As we move forward, we will continue strongly to support the testing program agreed upon by the Commissioner's Office and the Players Association. We feel that this program is an effective step in eradicating the use of performance-enhancing substances, and we continue to support this endeavor 100%. We also wish to thank Senator Mitchell for his efforts. Join me in thanking Senator Mitchell as we now move to your questions. Well, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. First, it was a pleasure to see Drayton again. I've had the pleasure of knowing him for many years in the past. Also, another reason I wanted to come here is a very dear friend of mine is a prominent graduate of Baylor, and that's Charles Butt from San Antonio.
Wonderful family.
He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. And, of course, I'd been here before to the law school at the invitation of Bernie Rappaport, who was a dear friend. If I could say this about baseball and performance-enhancing drugs and sports generally, you have to put it in a context. Every society has laws which prohibit murder and robbery. No one expects that because of the existence of those laws that all murders and robberies will cease. We recognize the fallibility of humans and the weakness of humans and the propensity of many humans to engage in wrongdoing. But we pass these laws and we enforce them both to provide specific punishment to those who break the norms of society by violating the law and also to serve as a deterrent for others. So it is with performing enhancing substances in sports. At this very moment, here in the United States, in China, in Eastern Europe, and possibly other areas, there are persons engaged in illegal activity, in attempting to devise new chemical compounds that will enhance athletic performance without being detectable by current systems of testing. Mm. One step, each side is trying to gain the advantage over the other. As each new substance is tried, discovered, used, discovered, then a parallel in sequence behind effort is made to discover a test that will determine it, either through urine testing or through blood testing. And so it's a constant battle. The incentives are so enormous to cheat that you have to assume, and it is, I think, a very, very safe assumption, that there are always going to be people who do it. When you think about it, take professional baseball. A young boy from an impoverished background with a limited education sees two choices in life. One, the average Major League Baseball player makes several million dollars a year. The other, a life of possible unemployment, or even if you're employed at poor wages and no recognition. For them, it's tough to balance the scales in the right way with what they would regard as abstract appeals to justice and fair play and so forth. So what we have to do as a society is to continue to make clear our very strong disapproval and condemnation of the use of illegal substances, whether for enhancing sports performance or otherwise. And we also have to engage vigorously in the scientific effort to discover tests to determine these, and we have to establish rigorous regimes of testing so that those who do engage in such activity can be detected and appropriately punished. And the biggest victims of all, the group that suffers the most direct injury, are those players who are forced to make a decision. Do I cheat and by so doing break the rules and break the law? Or do I not cheat and in so doing place myself at a competitive disadvantage and place my livelihood for my family and my career at risk? They're the biggest victims. They're the ones who should be out front saying, let's clean this thing up. That unfortunately hasn't been the case, but I think a growing number of them are coming to recognize that they shouldn't be put in the position of making that choice. And that means vigorous enforcement. I do want to say that Bud Selig, the commissioner of baseball, in my judgment, has not received the credit he deserves. He is the only commissioner of a professional sport in the United States who commissioned a completely independent investigation and inquiry. When he asked me to do this, I said, Bud, I have one condition, and that is I must have total independence. I'm gonna report what I find, I'm gonna tell it as I see it, and if you can't accept that, then go get someone else. He said, I not only accept it, I endorse it, I support it, and he did. No other sport has done that. And I think while he's gotten a lot of flack for it, he deserves praise for it, because whatever happened before, he did this, he stood by his promise, and within 24 hours after I made my recommendation, he unilaterally implemented all of the recommendations which he had the authority to implement. Many of them are required by law to be the subject of collective bargaining with the Players Association. And they did have a negotiation. Not all were accepted by the players. Hopefully they're continuing to make progress steadily along the way toward an effective regime. But nobody should think of this as a problem that's all of a sudden going to disappear or go away. It's an ongoing management of another example of human fallibility, and we have to deal with it in that way.
Well, we again appreciate your efforts and also what you're doing with respect to Penn State as we remain vigilant in college athletics as well. Madam Provost.
Well, and that's where I wanted to pick up. We had lots of questions about baseball and performance-enhancing drugs, but I wonder if you might comment on the state of college athletics and particularly the role that you expect to take up in your leadership as the athletics integrity monitor at Penn State.
Yeah. Well, I'll make my answer independent of that.
Okay.
I think we all have to keep reminding ourselves that as much as we love sports, the objectives of institutions of education is education. Mm. And that has to, should, and must come first. I say that as I played sports myself in college. I have three older brothers who are very famous athletes. I'm going to tell a story about that before we finish. And I understand the importance of sports. I told Ken earlier, I have a 15-year-old son who's a big Redskins fan, and when I tell him I sat in the same room that Robert G. Griffin III sat in, he's going to be thrilled to hear that. And of course, all sports fans know about Brittany Griner and the Lady Bears. But the reality is that the primary role of colleges and universities is education. And I think that in some cases in our society, that has been the subject of lip service and not actual implementation. And I think it's important that we all keep in mind that while it's great, I mean, sports are great, I think they teach important lessons in life. And I encourage my children to participate actively in all sports. They have to be second. The objective is to educate our young men and women. I want to just add a point to what was said earlier about that immigrant man who said that to me, and about my own personal history. My mother couldn't read or write, never went to school. My father left school after the third grade. They lived in poverty and they died in poverty, but by their standards, they had a very successful life because their goal in life was to see that their children had the education they never had. And all five of us graduated from college, and several of us with graduate degrees. And it is that desire to see that our children have opportunity, have a good start in life, that I think ought to be motivating all of us and all of us who are involved in education. So I think, to me, the lesson is, let's keep our priorities straight. And we all know what our priorities ought to be.
Thank you. That's so important. And if I could add one thing, we're very thankful here that at Baylor University, we've been very thankful to have very successful athletic programs, and last year was the year of the Bear, et cetera. But our 600 student athletes in our 19 sports have a average GPA of 3.2. So we're very, very thankful at Baylor, our students are student athletes.
Right. That's very commendable.
Thank you.
Well, as provost of the university and as the one responsible for academics, if I could stop the program now, I would. But I think that should be the message we leave with. But let's transfer this then to students, and let's talk to our students. There's a lot of students in the audience. And so we had a question. What advice do you have for a young person considering a career in public service?
I can think of no better way to make a contribution to your society and to have a sense of fulfillment in your own life than that of service to others. It doesn't have to be politics as we think about an elective office. There are many ways in which one can do so. The fact is that because we are so fortunate to be Americans, to be citizens of what is, despite our many imperfections, the most open, the most just, the most free society in all of human history, we're very fortunate, and our children especially are particularly fortunate now in the 21st century to be able to get an education, to go on, to succeed. And many of the students here will want and achieve status, wealth, fame, success. What you will find is that the more of that you achieve, the more you will come to realize that there are other things in life. And I don't think there's anything greater than being part of a large cause, larger than one's self-interest, which contributes to the well-being of others. Public service is one way to do it. There are a lot of disadvantages. There's a lot of slings and arrows with going, serving and running for public office and serving in public office. Every one of us fears failure. And there's no more public failure than seeking a public office and not gaining it. But for those of you who do, I strongly encourage it. And I think if you are very lucky, the students here, if you are very lucky, you will find such a cause in your lifetime.
I think sometimes current events are what caused some of these questions to be written, and so I wonder if you would comment about the legacy of a public servant just across the pond, former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher.
I had the pleasure of knowing Mrs. Thatcher. She came to Washington, I was Senate Majority Leader, and I hosted her for luncheon and escorted her onto the Senate floor, for which I got quite a few angry messages from Irish Americans. There was then a country, she wasn't too popular in Ireland at the time, or still. But we became good friends, and she introduced me on a couple of occasions when I made appearances in the United Kingdom. I think that it is fair to say that she was one of the most important and influential public figures in the modern history of the United Kingdom, and had a decisive impact on making changes in their economy that were needed. She was not universally supported. She was, of course, forced out of office by her own party because her popularity was declining sharply, and they feared a massive defeat at the next election. So her own party ousted her. They ended up delaying the defeat by one election, but it came anyway. So on balance, I think she was an impressive, important figure who, while many disagreed with some of her policies, all agreed that she was a person of conviction who acted on what she believed and did have a decisive and, I think, to a significant degree, positive effect on the economic structure of the United Kingdom.
For our last question, I wonder if you might reflect on what you view as your most enduring legislative accomplishment.
I have honestly never thought of it in terms of a single bill. To me, my most important accomplishment is not legislative in nature, but it was the establishment of a scholarship program in my home state of Maine after I left the Senate, under which we now give out a scholarship to a graduate of every high school in Maine each year. And since it's been created, the short time since I left the Senate, we've distributed more than $10 million in direct assistance to over 2,000 needy students, all of whom are terrific, able, most impressive young people. And to me, that's the best thing I've ever done. And I'll tell you a little story about that. I was appointed to the Senate, as you indicated, and when we close, I want to tell a humorous story about that. And I went to a conference at the University of Maine, the subject of which was the aspirations of young people in Maine. It was quite distressing that the conclusion was that the aspirations were very low. And the organizers of the conference asked me to speak to the students because they knew about my background, and many of these youngsters in Maine came from similar backgrounds, small town, relatively poor, uneducated parents, lacking in focus or aspiration. And I did talk to them about it, and that's when the idea of going to every high school in Maine came up. The principals asked me to go. They said kids will relate to someone with a similar background. And as I traveled around, I saw many young kids who reminded me of myself at their age. I was 16 years old when I graduated from high school. My father had lost his job that year. He was unemployed for a year. It almost destroyed him and our family. It was a very tough year. And there was really no prospect of my going to college. My three older brothers had gone on athletic scholarships. They were very prominent athletes. I was not. By great good fortune, a local businessman who I didn't even know, who had gone to Bowdoin, arranged for me to go and to have an interview and eventually get in, and I worked. My deal with Bowdoin was I worked nearly full-time, going a variety of jobs, going through. I want to correct one thing. I was not an insurance adjuster in Maine. I did that in law school in Washington when I was there. So that's why I was able later.
I stand corrected.
That's why.
No wonder you got 81% of the vote.
That's why. That's why I was able to win election later. And so, I went, and as I said, I'd never been anywhere. My parents didn't own a car. I was really insecure, naive, and as I traveled around Maine when I got in the Senate, I saw so many of these kids who reminded me of myself. And I said, I've been so lucky. I've had so many good things happen to me, people helping me who had no motive other than to help a kid, that I got to do something to help these kids. And that was the genesis of my scholarship program, which continues to this day, and it's really worked out extremely well. And I guess if I'm proud of anything, it's that.
Outstanding.
This has been a very serious evening. Usually I tell a few jokes, so let me conclude with one.
Good.
All right, if you don't mind.
Please.
As Ken pointed out in the introduction, I entered the Senate by appointment. I was serving as a federal judge in my home state of Maine when one of Maine's senators was appointed Secretary of State. The governor announced that because it was in the middle of a legislative session, he was going to move very quickly. And he said next Monday he's going to hold a press conference at the state capitol to announce his choice to replace Senator Muskie. There was a former senator, a former governor, two former congressmen, all were prominent news. My name was not among them. I'd only been appointed a federal judge the year before. So that Sunday night, I went to bed early. We all go to bed early in Maine. And wondering what the governor was going to do at the press conference the next day. About 11 o'clock at night, the phone rang. It was the governor on the phone. He said, I'd like you to come down to the state capitol where I can announce tomorrow noon that I'm going to appoint you to the Senate. I said, well, gee, Governor, this is a big surprise. I said, this is a really big decision. I need time to think about it. I got to talk to my family. He said, I'll give you 1 hour. And when I protested it was inadequate, he insisted. So I hung up, and I called my three older brothers, to whom I referred earlier this evening, very prominent athletes throughout New England, not just our little town. I came along in our small town, and I was not as good an athlete as my brothers. And so very early in my life, I became known as Johnny Mitchell's kid brother, the one who isn't any good. As you might expect, I developed a massive inferiority complex and a highly competitive attitude toward my brothers. And so when I called them that night, after hearing from the governor, it was ostensibly to seek their advice. But there was no mistaking. I said, guys, the governor just called. He wants to appoint me to the Senate. What do you think about that? Now, so the responses were, predictably, very negative. My brother Johnny said, look, he said, you're a born loser. He said, you couldn't possibly win a statewide election. Nobody can understand how you got to be a federal judge. So you better stay there. It's a lifetime appointment. My older brother, who fancies himself an intellectual, he likes to use a Socratic method. You ask questions to make a point. He began by saying, well, he said, shouldn't we think of this in terms of the people of Maine? Aren't they entitled to have a qualified person representing them in the U.S. Senate? And he said, isn't it obvious that you're not one of them? So I hung up the phone, I called the governor, I said, Governor, I don't need an hour. I've already received all the reassurance I need of my ability to perform this job. I'll be there at noon tomorrow. I went to the state capitol the next day at noon. The governor made the announcement. I flew to Washington. The swearing-in was scheduled for the following morning, a Tuesday. And on the flight down, I fantasized. I wonder whether all three networks will carry it live. Certainly, I said, one or two of them at least. I had notions of grandeur. When the plane landed late afternoon, I didn't have anything to do that night. So when I got in the taxi, literally on a whim, I said, take me up to the Capitol. I want to go up and I'll go and meet the majority leader, introduce myself to him. So I did. A clerk took me into the Senate, which was debating a bill. And Senator Byrd was then the majority leader. And I went in to meet him, never dreaming that within just a few years I would be the majority leader. That was the furthest thing from my mind. And I introduced myself to him, and he was very busy, and he was under the impression that since I was there, I was to be sworn in. So he said, okay, he said, we're very busy, but we'll swear you. And I said, no. I said, the swearing in's tomorrow. Look, he said, son, he said, we're very busy here. If I say we're going to swear you in now, we're going to swear you in now. So he interrupted the debate. I was sworn in. It took less than 10 seconds. Senator standing 6 feet away, were unaware of what had occurred. And then The Senate resumed, and almost immediately a vote occurred. I hold the all-time record in American history of having cast a vote the shortest time after entering the Senate, 2 minutes. And that was the first of many informed judgments I made in your behalf. And in behalf of others. But we didn't talk much about the Senate, but I want to say it's a great institution. I loved it. I loved being there. I enjoyed the people. Very difficult, contentious at times. I had many sleepless nights. But it is, in fact, a microcosm of our democratic system and a microcosm of our country. And I know it's a subject of much criticism now. There's much abuse of it, and a good bit of it is well deserved. We all have to can improve. But basically, since I've left, I have a somewhat more benign perspective than when I was in the middle of the fight. And I just conclude with what I said before. We're lucky to be Americans. In this country, nobody should be guaranteed success, but everybody should have a fair chance to succeed. That's what America is.
Senator, thank you. Magnificent.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
Magnificent.
This On Topic conversation was recorded April 16th, 2013 at Baylor University. You can access this audio on the KWBU website. Look for On Topic in the program archives under the Programs tab on the homepage at kwbu.org.